Hello and welcome to Tantramar Report on CHMA 106.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Sackville, New Brunswick, the heart of the Maritimes, in the traditional lands of the Mi'kmaq people, unceded in the Treaties of Peace and Friendship, first signed with settlers in 1725. I'm Erica Butler. It's Tuesday, July 27th. Coming up on today's show, we chat with local town councillor Sabine Dietz about her new job leading Climb Atlantic, a new regional hub for climate services funded for the next 3 years by the federal government. Dietz will remain based in Sackville and lead a team from across Atlantic Canada. We'll hear from Dietz right after some more local news and information. Nova Scotia says it will not be making changes to its border rules for New Brunswickers after this province ends all pandemic restrictions on July 31st. Nova Scotia Health and Wellness spokesperson Kristen Lipscomb told CHMA by email that at this time, we don't anticipate any changes to Nova Scotia's border policy as a result of New Brunswick lifting its restrictions at the end of July. Last Friday, Premier Blaine Higgs announced the mandatory order that brought in rules such as mandatory masks and gathering limits will not be renewed in New Brunswick. All public health restrictions are lifted as of midnight this coming Friday. Public Health reported one new case of COVID-19 in the province on Monday. A person in their 60s in Fredericton contracted the disease from travel. There are now 6 active cases of COVID-19 in the province, and one of those is in Zone 1. A previous case that was under investigation is now considered travel-related. There were 2 new cases of COVID-19 in PEI reported yesterday, but the cases won't register in PEI because they are in travelers from another province. A news release from PEI Public Health says 2 unvaccinated people tested positive upon entry to the province after coming from outside of Atlantic Canada. Those results were later confirmed in a PCR test. PEI Public Health also issued an exposure advisory for a flight from Montreal to Charlottetown on July 24th. Sackville and Amherst have both been named most active community in their respective provinces by the Participation Community Challenge. Both towns will receive $15,000 in funding towards community physical health initiatives as a result, thanks to funding contributed by the provinces. Sackville had 462 users registered to track their active minutes for the month of June, over twice as many as any other community in New Brunswick. Those people, as well as local teams and organizations, tracked over 3.1 million move minutes during the challenge. The town of Sackville is asking for public input on its Facebook page for how to spend the $15,000 in funding. Ideas floated so far include putting the money towards bigger projects like the skate park or a pedway across the Trans-Canada. People have also suggested mowing the dikes behind the industrial park, creation of a measured flat walking track for all ages, and improving access to the rail trails in Middle Sackville. As if Sabine Dietz hasn't already taken on enough this year, what with her recent election to Sackville Town Council, the Sackville biologist and environmental educator has now been chosen to lead Climb Atlantic, a new regional hub for climate services funded for the next 3 years by the federal government. I spoke with Dietz last week to learn a bit more about Climb Atlantic and her role in it. Sabine Dietz, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You are taking on a brand new role in Sackville with a brand new organization. Can you tell us a bit about Climb Atlantic?
So Climb Atlantic is one of a number of regional hubs across Canada that work on providing climate data and climate information and services to basically anybody who needs to deal with the risks from climate change. So they were set up under a concept that the federal government came up with, Environment and Climate Change Canada, in 2018. And there is a federal Canadian Centre for Climate Services that exists. And so over the last years, that services centre has worked with the various provinces to set up these kind of regional hubs to help advance decision-making based on evidence. That's what it is, yeah.
All right. So, yeah, this is a new term for me, climate services. I'm guessing, you know, Environment Canada had been sort of, I guess, the go-to for this role for a long time, but now it's expanding and we need more, I guess, places to go for reliable data? And is that sort of the purpose behind this?
Yeah, so it's a bit convoluted, and I fully admit that, because I've been in the adaptation, climate change adaptation space, since 2010. So, I've been there at the beginning of when provinces started to develop tools, especially for municipalities around climate change risk assessments and so on. So there's a lot that went on since 2010 in the provinces, all across Canada. There was a program in place at that time, and there was a lot of data created, a lot of different models, a lot of tools developed to help people, in many cases, especially initially focused on municipalities, and later on including other sectors, the agriculture sector, forestry sector, fishery sector, and people, of course. So there were a lot of these things developed all across the country. And then in 2018, the Climate Services and the Canadian Centre for Climate Services was established. And that was really, I shouldn't say consolidate, but manage a bit sort of a flow of information. So provide a moderated kind of type of access to data and information. So, at the Canadian Centre for Climate Services, what you have access to currently is a climate atlas, which is sort of a public face of, well, what does it actually look like in my community? What will happen? What's the future? Then there's a second piece with its climatedata.ca, which provides more specific data. So, for example, if you go on climatedata.ca, it provides across the country information on temperature, increases in temperature under different scenarios. It's a little bit more detailed. And then there's a specific tool that is for academics and researchers. So these are sort of the three pieces that the Canadian Centre for Climate Services has currently developed, and those are in place. On a regional level, the thing is that it's curated data or curated information that's really important, because things are flying at us from all over the place. What is it actually that we should use when we look at sea level rise? What is it that is most pertinent in terms of temperature increases, drought risk or flood risk, and sort of really consolidating this a little bit without really taking away all the work that's going on already by researchers, academia, NGOs, stakeholders, government. Each of the four governments plus Indigenous governments, they have already approaches to adaptation. They're doing risk assessments. They have data. They have identified what kind of information people need, what is needed. In some areas like PI, the erosion is a huge factor, sea level rise and erosion. So there's specific tools developed on PI through the University of Prince Edward Island. And then there's other information that is specific to other communities. So Nova Scotia has developed, has worked around the wine industry. How can the wine industry adapt? And so this has been going on all over Atlantic Canada for the last 10 years. And so Climate Atlantic, it's not gonna add more data, more information, create our own set of information. It's really facilitating access, moderating the access to what's out there. So if somebody in PI is literally looking for erosion information, we would then send them to the University of Prince Edward Island's tool that they've developed. Or if somebody is looking in Nova Scotia is looking specifically for sea level rise information, we will make sure that they know where that specific information is located for Nova Scotia. So it's a bit that. So I'm already expanding. I know I should let you ask the question.
No. So yeah, so basically Climate Atlantic will be sort of the go-to spot to find out where the best information is.
That, I think, what the plan was, to take the pressure a bit off the individual provincial governments, because in reality, when you look at sea level rise, there's a problem in most places in Atlantic Canada, not in all. The governments that dealing with those requests for sea level rise information, they don't all have to duplicate what they're doing, what they need in terms of data. It could be a bit more, okay, so if you're looking for sea level rise, this is what's available. And in fact, I should say sea level rise, the climatedata.ca, there's a tool there where you can actually look for your specific location what sea level rise will be looking will look like in the future. So it's actually a very advanced tool that they have. For other things like, storm surge information, that's a little bit more tricky because that really differs from, let's say, the Bay of Fundy to Prince Edward Island. The impacts are different. So it's a more specialized kind of information that people will need that is not necessarily available nationally right now. So that is more something that we'll definitely be working on to make sure that it gets incorporated. But yes.
Yeah. Is it fair to say that the focus is on adaptation and the knowing what is happening to the climate and what the effects will be, as opposed to the mitigation or trying to prevent the changes to the climate?
Yes, so that's definitely the focus. But I should say, while we have this habit of separating those two very strongly, the adaptation side in terms of, yes, we need to deal with the impacts and the risks that are caused by these hazards, drought and sea level rise and floods. But the mitigation side is being recognized as more and more intricately connected. So when you, for example, look at some of the work that is especially going on in the Maritimes around natural solutions to climate change. When we're thinking about that, we're thinking, especially in the Sackville area, we're thinking about the naturalized stormwater management pond we have. We're thinking about some of the salt marsh restorations that are happening out in the Bay of Fundy through St. Mary's University and through Mount Allison University is involved in that one as well. So some of this is, well, we're thinking, okay, so this is primarily adaptation, reducing our inland flood risk, for example, with the naturalized stormwater management pond, or increasing the salt marsh area in front of the dikes to provide a buffer against the wave action and the rising sea levels, right? So, but especially in terms of wetlands, there's a considerable component of mitigation because wetlands, whether they're salt marshes or as our naturalized stormwater management pond grows, any kind of marsh actually captures carbon. So whenever you have dying plant matter and it gets incorporated into the sediment, you basically capture carbon. You sequester carbon into the sediment, and that is mitigation, right? That's taking greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. So that means that yes, our center, like the Climate Atlantic, will deal with primarily providing data so people can make an information and services so people, agencies, municipalities, and so on can make decisions based on evidence. But the second piece, the mitigation piece, especially on using nature to help address climate change, that is where things very clearly overlap. And I would say, with things like what EOS Eco Energy has been doing, the rain gardens, the green roof on top of town hall, those are things that are also overlapping both adaptation and mitigation. So the green roof will pick up water, will retain water, so less water runs off, meaning less water goes into our stormwater management system, which is an adaptation piece. But the green roof will also reduce heat in the building. It'll have all sorts of other impacts, effects that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions from energy use in the building. So that's where this gets a little bit, the separation isn't as distinct as we often make it.
Right. Now, this is going to be based, Climate Atlantic is going to be based in Sackville. Why Sackville?
Well, it's more a result of where I am. So the press release said there was a competitive process, which is true. There was a request for proposals and it took quite a while. I myself, with a small group of people, organizations, submitted one proposal and that won out. And so in that proposal process, I committed to acting as executive director for the center. And that's why it's here. But I should put this in quotation marks because the team is actually a virtual team. So I can just explain a little bit what the team will look like. It's a small team, but it's a bit complicated. So I myself am here in Sackville. The lead on data and end user services is actually in Moncton, Réal Daigh, who's a very well-known sea level rise expert in the province and beyond. And the engagement and knowledge mobilization specialist will be located out of out of Nova Scotia, so it's already virtual. There's no office currently. I don't know what it will be like in the future. In addition to those people, those two, which already have been hired, there's a third, a communication specialist, who will be hired to make sure that the information is all out there. Currently, we don't have a website. We don't have a Facebook page. The press release is the first time that we're publicly out there, but there really needs to be a front end that is very public so people know where to go. And then on top of that, each of the provinces is putting money into this as well in terms of hiring a climate services specialist at the provincial level. So there will be four additional people, at least one in each province, that will be under Climate Atlantic, but working, you know, in Fredericton or in Halifax or in St. John's or in Charlottetown. So it's a small team, but totally spread out. So it made no sense to have an office space at this time. That may change.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is the era of fewer office spaces, I guess.
Yes, it is.
People have figured it out. The pandemic has forced us to.
And made some things possible because it's a lot easier to do this now than it would have been, you know, a year and a half ago.
Now, the funding is meant to cover 3 years of operations. So, I mean, that's a healthy, I guess, runway to mm-hmm. Get things started for this organization. You also have another commitment that you've recently taken on that will last a similar amount of time. How did it happen that you're taking on both? We know you're recently newly elected councillor at the mm-hmm. Sackville Town Council. That's obviously a part-time gig. That's not meant to be a full-time job by any means. Lots of other councillors are employed if you are retired. It seems to me that you're taking on sort of two big things right now in your life. How did that come about and how do you feel about it?
Yeah, so when the nominations opened for council, the approval of the RFP or the proposal hadn't happened, so I didn't know. Probably I may not have run for council if I had known, because this is big. It is fairly big, building a regional, Atlantic Canada wide organization from the ground up. So I'm fully conscious of this commitment with the organization, but council, it was important to me. And as you may remember, I was pretty clear on what I wanted to do on council, put a climate lens on the decisions that we make, with climate change being the defining, emergency of our time, and the need for action, has been clear for many years. So that's what I wanted to do. So that makes it a bit heavy in terms of the load of work. But on the other hand, it is also, I think it's a unique opportunity to, on one hand, have my foot in, a type of stakeholder in the climate space that I still believe, I do believe, and I believe for many years, can have the most impact in making roadway or headway in terms of both on the adaptation as well the mitigation side. And we always think municipalities have very little power, but the reality is that it's not power, but it's influence. And, it is, communities do make decisions. We do make decisions on council that affect both, our ability to be resilient when there are emergencies, as well as reducing our emissions overall in the community, and our contribution to climate change. So it's a unique opportunity to have my foot in both ends. On one end, in a place where these changes that we need are, will happen and have a huge impact, and on the other hand, on the type of provider side where usually people try to figure out how to best communicate with the stakeholders. And so, I have the perspective of a town, of a council, of how decisions are made and how we can communicate within a community or we can't. And on the other hand, trying to develop and help those kind of stakeholders making good decisions, evidence-based decisions. So it's a it's in some ways, the double load makes it harder. But on the other hand, I'm really glad that it happened this way. It's almost like it had to happen, because I think it'll make my work with Climate Atlantic a lot better, having that second role with Municipal Council. Just better understanding, better knowledge of what happens on the ground, you know, the limitations and where we need to help municipalities overcome those limitations and barriers that they have.
Okay, Sabina. The announcement for this went out last week. The Climate Atlantic itself will be up and running by the fall. Is that it? Is that the sort of timeline for it?
Yes. There will be an official launch. Now, this was just a press release, very low key, but there will be an official launch. I'm not exactly sure when, but there'll be sort of a big to do, because of course the politicians would like to be there. So, you know, hopefully it'll be at a time where we can actually get together and have a sort of a press release and a meeting, maybe a conference or something. But that's not to say that nothing is happening right now. So, you know, I'm in the process of, as I'm hiring, I'm also in the process of meeting with various stakeholders across the four provinces to get a first handle on what is currently going on in terms of both the adaptation side as well as the research and developing tools, etc. Compiling all of that, it's a start of a needs assessment, right? First, you need to figure out, well, what is happening? What are people doing? You know, what do the provinces want? The provincial governments, what do they need? And then, sort of, that has already started. So while we're just staffing up, the work is already happening in terms of identifying, you know, from that end, from the needs end, all the way to, well, what kind of data, what's coming down the pipe with the next international report on climate change, you know, how does that trickle down to our regions? All of that is already happening. So yes, we'll officially launch in the fall, but there'll be more well before that, and we'll be public well before that. So website, I expect end of July, early August, and then we'll sort of really start being more out there.
Thanks for sharing. Thanks for speaking with us today, Sabina.
You're welcome.
That was Sackville biologist and environmental consultant Sabine Dietz, who has just been hired to head up the federal government's new regional hub for climate services, Climate Atlantic. That's it for CHMA's Tantramar Report for this Tuesday, July 27th. As always, for story ideas, tips, or feedback, contact us at news@chmafm.com. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.